Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show, and I have Sean in studio. The show is about what matters most in life to you, our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. So in this show, what I'm going to talk about is research about vaping and cigarette and what it does to the mind of the teen and to all of us, even as adults. And then I will speak to Molly Punpadit, which is the CEO of the SOAR Community Network. She's a TEDx speaker, two times number one international best-selling author and a podcaster. And she's an executive producer and a host of Tea with Molly at a cable TV show. So I'm excited to have her on. You can call us and talk to Molly and I in studio line 951-922-3532. Love to hear from you and for you guys to be part of our conversation. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
So I saw the movie Star is Born last night, and it was really interesting. I had seen the Star is Born, which was with Kris Kristofferson and Barbara Streisand, 1970s, when I just came to the United States, and I just fell in love with that movie. And I really wanted to see the one that was just in with Lady Gaga. I was really impressed with the movie, but one of the things that it brought up for me, since I do work a lot with addiction, and relationships. So I was looking at it from the perspective of addiction and how much the concept of addiction is about attachment. And that's why many times when a person falls in love and they really enjoy being in somebody's company at the beginning, it also becomes a motivator for them to let go of their addiction. Many of the addicts, they come to me or they go to recovery because they just fall in love. And the same type of a surge of dopamine is in their brain. The type of attachment and craving is with their lover. So it's almost like a different type of a substitution, that their lover shows up and they want to take care of themselves. They get that type of joy and the bliss that they experience with the addiction also being in love. So for the beginning and the honeymoon phase of love, it always works. And the person has, you know, is trying to keep themselves clean and healthy. And that's even for the people who are really not on denial. And then after a while, you see that the surge comes down, and therefore they keep going through their craving and everything that they wanted to use, they'll go back and use. Sometimes we look at addiction as a disease of attachment, where the attachment is not healthy, because as children grow up, obviously they need a healthy attachment to their primary caretaker. Usually maybe their mother, grandmother, somebody who's taking care of them, their father. If that type of an attachment is something that is healthy and it doesn't produce anxiety for them, it's not inconsistent, that it is consistent, and the child can kind of like flourish in the space of that type of an attachment, then you could definitely see the experience of the child growing up and not necessarily forming that type of anxiety that needs that, you know, to be kind of like toned down or numbed with any type of addiction. addiction. But beside that, obviously we'll talk about other types of addiction too. But the movie brought up for me the way that some people think about this type of love as an essence where they can let go of their addiction, which doesn't work. Then we talk about self-love. Does it take self-love in order for you not to be addicted? Not necessarily. I think self-love becomes the byproduct of the recovery that you go through. But many people don't reach that type of a self-love in order to first to gain self-love and then let go of their addiction. People usually have to go and start recovery programs before they can actually gain the concept of self-worth and self-love. And beyond that, I think one more aspect of it that's interesting is the essence of having a purpose bigger than yourself, not just about yourself. It becomes necessary for a person to not only go beyond who they are and go through their recovery, but also to keep being in recovery and not go back to their craving and to their addiction. This concept of self-love, I think that it helps and it becomes a byproduct, but the concept of a love bigger than us, some purpose bigger than us, and for us to feel a sense of who we are as a human being, which we are giving to the say next generation and to the community around us, might be a better purpose for the concept of recovery. Because when we get very, very selfish in the aspect of when we are an addict, all we think about is ourselves, the pleasure that needs to be given to us, and nobody matters at that moment. And the responsibility that we need to take about when I go through my addiction, I create a mess not only for myself, but for everyone else. And sometimes the responsibility of being for other people creates that bigger cause where we can contain ourselves, we can go through to recovery, we can create the self-love and respect for ourselves and others, worth for ourselves and everyone else, and the responsibility and impact that we actually create for others. And hopefully that, you know, the attachments that are in your life are healthy and that you feel responsible and proud of who you are as a citizen who actually lives among all other people and impacts everyone else. We'll be right back with the latest research about nicotine, cigarettes, smoking, addiction, and vape.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back to the Inner Voice. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. Now, I have the latest research from a couple of different universities for you today. So when a person takes a puff on a cigarette, nicotine floods into the brain, latching onto receptors on the surface of neurons and producing feelings of happiness. But nicotine does not simply stay on the surface of the cell. The drug actually permeates into a neural cell and alters them from the inside out. Now, a team of scientists has developed a protein sensor that glows in the presence of nicotine, allowing the researchers to observe nicotine's movements in cells and reveal more about the nature of nicotine addiction. The study was done in Caltech and was published in Journal of General Physiology. Scientists can put the biosensors into a particular part of the cell. In this work, they place the they place the protein in the endoplasmic reticulum and on the cell surface and watch them light up as nicotine floods in. By making movies of the cell containing biosensors in the lab dish, the team has discovered that nicotine enters into the endoplasmic reticulum within a few seconds of appearing outside a cell. Furthermore, the nicotine levels are more than enough to affect nicotine receptors during their assembly and to chaperone additional nicotine receptors on their journey to the cell surface. As a result, the neurons are more sensitive to the nicotine, which enhances the rewarding feelings after a puff on a tobacco cigarette or e-cigarette. In other words, the more a person smokes, the more quickly and easily the smoker gets the nicotine buzz. This is part of the way that the nicotine is addictive. And many people know that nicotine is one of the hardest addictions to quit. Another study from the University of Waterloo and the Wake Forest School of Medicine found that students in grades 7 to 12, yes, grades 7 to 12, who had tried an e-cigarette are 2.16 times more likely to be susceptible to cigarette smoking. Now, concerns about the addictive nature of cigarettes, now used by an estimated 2 out of 5 high schoolers. I'm not kidding you. That's the rate. 2 out of 5 high schoolers, and in the U.S. and in 1 out of 20 Americans in total may be a part of an evolving public health. Researchers in Yale University have reported that vaping and e-cigarette and cigarette smoking have a biological and psychological component. Psychosocial, actually, component to them. When the person smokes a cigarette, they actually change the dopamine in their body. And the concentration of dopamine changes in the brain. So that even watching someone who is smoking can start triggering your craving. So the younger the developing brain is getting addicted and using cigarette, the faster they will get addicted and the harder it is in order for them to actually quit. So another data being presented at American College of Cardiology's 68th annual scientific session, new research shows that adults who report puffing e-cigarettes or vaping are significantly more likely to have a heart attack, a coronary artery disease, and depression compared with those who don't use them or any types of tobacco products. So e-cigarettes vapor boosts the production of inflammatory chemicals and disables key protective cells in the protective cells in the lung and keep the airspace clear of potentially harmful particles. Reveals a small experiential study published on reveals a small experiential study published online in the Journal of Thorax. So in another small study, they said that infrequent cannabis users, John Hopkins and medicine researchers have shown that compared with smoking cannabis vaping, it increases the rate of anxiety, paranoia, memory loss, and distraction when doses were the same. So as you can see, the vaping industry is not only opening people more to cigarette smoking, and most people who haven't even smoked cigarette before and they started with vaping, they opened themselves up to cigarette smoking. But even when they were using regular cannabis use versus vaping cannabis, it was affecting them more. So you're looking at how the addiction can start and what it would do to your body and to your brain. And now you're also watching that the cell, it goes inside the cells, and when the recovery starts, it takes a longer time for it to be cleaned up from your body. I remember when I smoked probably from the age 12 or 13, yeah, very young, all the way to 35. And then I quit a couple of times, and then I relapsed a couple of times until I finally quit about 20 years ago. It was really hard, but it was like a lot of people did not know that after many, many years of still not smoking cigarette, that when I went to exercise, my whole body became toxic again because the fat cells were bursting and nicotine and was, you know, all getting over, I felt overpowered by nicotine in my body again. And I was going to hospitals almost every single week in order to take care of myself. And it was still very, very hard. So yes, I started early. I finally quit 2 years ago. I'm really happy that I did. And at that time, we didn't even know how toxic all of it was. So I hope that this information also helps you if you wanted to quit smoking and not thinking and being in denial that vaping is better than actually smoking. So I'm excited to be back here with Molly Ponpadit. She's the CEO of the SOAR Community Network. And she's a TEDx speaker, 2 times number one international best-selling author, marketing strategist, and business consultant, podcaster, and the executive producer, host of Tea with Molly cable TV show. In 2015, Molly was selected as the Believe Team community partner through Values Partnership of the Oprah Winfrey Own Network Belief Initiative. The SOAR Community Network works with the small and mid-sized conscious businesses, nonprofits, and brands to create and implement strategic plans with aligns their employees with their mission for a greater social impact. Molly is also a co-founder of SCN Nebula, a membership-based community and resource hub for conscious leaders desiring to create greater social impact. She's the producer, host of SOAR Community Podcast, and she's also a 4-time author, including A Million Fireflies. And that's her memoir about her voyage from war-torn Laos to America. Molly has been nominated for several awards, including Heroines of Washington, D.C., and awarded by March of Dimes, and twice for the Woman of the Year Award by New Network Executives Women. She was awarded the iBoss Navigated Award in 2018 for her work in helping small businesses message their mission and soar their businesses to success. 2017, she in Born to Be Me, it was a compilation of authentic stories from 19 international female authors, made Amazon's number one international bestseller list. And in 2018, she contributed to The Balancing Act, which also made the number one international bestseller list. Molly has shared her insights at hundreds of events, corporate retreats, classrooms, boardrooms, and conferences, including the Congress of Congress, the Library of Congress, Smithsonian's, University of Maryland, George Mason University, Huffington Post, Entrepreneur.com, Today's Magazine, Asian Fortune Newspaper, American Meditating Radio with Dear Sister Jenna, and Voice of America. So we'll be right back with Molly Ponpadit.
Dr. Fujian Zane is a psychotherapist, a marriage and family therapist, and a life coach with more than 27 years of experience. She is the author of the Awareness Integration Model, which has been researched and published in numerous international journals. Dr. Fujian has offices in Beverly Hills, Irvine, and Woodland Hills, California, and also consults online and by telephone. Make an appointment with her today by calling 818-648-2140 or go online to www.fujian.com. That's www.fujian.com. Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the Awareness Integration Model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140 or go to www.fujian.com.
Welcome back to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zane, and I'm so excited to have Molly Ponpadit with me. Hi, Molly.
Hello. How are you, Dr. Fujian?
I'm doing amazing. I miss you already. We met in India. We were the guest of American Meditating Radio with Sister Jenna. And I got to actually meet you and your wonderful husband and the team. And I really enjoyed our conversation, and I really wanted to have you on my show for you to talk about your experiences of kind of immigrating, the challenges that comes with it, how you found you and your resiliency, and how you're taking the same concept of vulnerability and resiliency and taking it into businesses and working with the leaders in their companies into bringing some conscientiousness into their system and the way that they treat each other, pretty much.
Well, I guess I can start by saying that when I came to the U.S., I was very young. I was 4 years old when we escaped Laos. And my parents, they showed me resiliency. They really were just instrumental in the way that I operate today. My father educated himself when he was younger. And so when we fled the country, it was through his creativity and innovation that got us out safely. And when we finally arrived to the U.S., there was a church in Maryland, I'm right outside of Washington, D.C., who sponsored our entire family of seven to come here mm-hmm. from the refugee camps of Thailand. And what I learned then was not only were my parents really strong, and they were scared. Certainly, they didn't speak the language, right? But they had this deep trust that what we had was better than what we would have experienced. So they were always looking at things from a positive vantage point. And so I learned that early on. And how did I get into the work of leadership? Well, when I look back on my life and I think about all of the mentors and people who showed up, the conscious leaders, the people who were filled with love and compassion and empathy, who saw this family in need, who didn't communicate very well with us because we didn't know the language, but they had a heart connection. They really were sympathetic, if not empathetic, to our needs. And why I am here today doing leadership work and working with these incredible souls to raise their level of consciousness and their role of leadership is because I think of all of those souls along the way, regardless of title, that really made an imprint in my family and allowed me to become educated, to now become an entrepreneur in Washington, D.C. Coming as a child refugee and becoming an entrepreneur is a total stretch of the imagination. But what made that possible were all the mentors along the way, all these conscious, mindful leaders, my teachers who saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. You know, the church members who went out of their comfort zone. It was a very small church. They didn't have money for themselves. And yet they were able to raise funds and bring a family of seven from the other side of the world. And I think that that's what inspires me today to help develop every human being into seeing, owning, articulating, and releasing their mission into the world. If they can do that, then they can save, support, and nurture people like me who needed it most when we were most vulnerable. That's my inspiration.
That is awesome. Molly, with being in Washington, D.C. right now, you live there, with all the rhetoric at this point about obviously America first and we shouldn't have any opening for people of other countries, of the foreigners, that they're coming here for growth. What are your thoughts, since you did come here as a foreigner? I came in when I was 12 years old from another country, and we gained and we give back to the community. What were your experiences, experiencing what you did and yet now facing the rhetoric that is around you, especially, I mean, around all of us, but mostly I can say that also in Washington, D.C., where you live?
Yeah. Well, we certainly feel the rhetoric because we're right here where the policies are being made. And, I am a 10-minute drive from Washington, D.C. We're in Northern Virginia and Old Town Alexandria, but we feel it. And for me personally, I don't feel the intensity or the prejudice or the pain because of the community that I've worked so hard to build and that my family has worked so hard to build. And I think the very important issue is that when you have a community of people who really see you as a human being and see you as a soul, they don't see you as a refugee. They don't see you as the other. They don't see the color of your skin beyond when they first met you and it just happened to be that you're in this vessel and that's what you look like. But it really comes down to us going out of our comfort zone to be curious about the other person, to know what their story is. I think once they understand where I came from, the story, the journey, that our parents never asked for handouts. My parents, we were on food stamps, and my father came home one day and I said, we're going to work really hard so that we don't have to depend on anybody else. And I think most immigrants and most refugees, they escape something horrid. They're not coming here because they're trying to take anything from. They just want a chance to live. And they want a chance to contribute and give back, you know, in exchange for a safe haven, really. I mean, that's the most simplified way that I can put it. And I think if we can just speak to one another as human beings, we won't be hearing that level of anger and fear, and we won't experience it as much. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen in all parts of the world. It doesn't even happen in this community. But in my community and who I choose to be around and the types of conversations that I choose to have, it makes it less painful.
Absolutely. And I get it that you really experience what compassion can do from the group, the church that opened up their heart. And not only that they opened up their heart, but they actually did something. They created a way to bring their compassion into your life. And the power of that compassion and how it heals the world, in a sense. And for me, being in the, obviously, the therapy world, compassion is the most important factor. Acceptance, compassion, seeing and valuing someone is the most important factor, where I could see it every day where somebody gets healed within that space. And I sense that you brought that, you experienced that, and then you were bringing that into the business world. And why business world? Why did you think that the business world really needed to experience that compassion?
Well, Dr. Fushan, I think every human being needs to experience it. And because I came into the world of business, that was what I studied, I witnessed a lot of things in the spirit of corporate America that was very painful for me, painful for me personally. And it taught me the type of leader that I really never want to be, right? And I think the business world, fortunately or unfortunately, runs the world. You know, we hire people. Livelihoods are at stake when you have businesses that flourish, when you have businesses that go bankrupt. And because of that, because of how society is run today, at least in the modern world, right, it's very important that if we're going to be impacted by businesses and business owners and business leaders, we need to then be able to tap into the human capacity of those leaders, helping them to recognize that their decisions matter, and not just for them and their pocketbook or their lifestyle, but everybody else who is affiliated and associated with the work that they do. You know, from building the products in a faraway land that they may never meet that person, you know, to the leader sitting next to you who's running the business with you. Every decision you make impacts the whole. And that's in business, that's in life. And because our corporate world is let's just say that, you know, we have lobbyists for a reason. I'm in Washington, D.C. It matters that there are businesses. Businesses should be around because we need that to have a healthy economy. What we strive to do, though, is help leaders understand their role, teach them mindfulness, help them tap into compassion, you know, understand that whatever products and services that you offer, is it truly serving the community to a greater good? And not all leaders buy into that, but we want to slowly and surely, one by one, one leader at a time, help them understand that their role does matter. It is life or death for many people that they impact based on their decisions.
They do. Now, when you're looking at the conscientious leader, what is your definition of a conscientious leader versus a leader that basically has the business in order to profit for themselves and move forward, although all businesses go for profit? But what is it that makes that difference?
Well, I think, you know, tapping into a leader who understands that to have a successful business, you have to have profit. But can you make a profitable business and serve a purpose? Can you elevate your level of profitability and share it, give it back so that it keeps coming to you? I mean, there's this law of karma, right? If you do the right thing and you're supporting the collective community, you have so many more brand ambassadors that are working for you. You have higher retention because people want to come to work to support a leader that's doing some good in the community. I think that the difference between a leader who wants to be profitable and knows that there is a purpose for that, to serve, to give, there's a philanthropic aspect to it, than just the person who is trying to create wealth and a better lifestyle for themselves and for those they love, and it stops there. I think that when you have a conscious, mindful leader, they are thinking about the entire ecosystem, all sentient beings on this planet. You know, I think that that is where mindfulness practices, meditation, really help us to go deeper to a place of spirituality that we weren't taught in business. We were told to leave personal at home and go to work and be professional. And it doesn't work because people get sick, people get burnt out, people get tired. They're not feeling connected to who they really are, and the whole person cannot come to work. That's a problem. And I think that's why we see so much evidence now of anxiety and depression in the workplace.
And it's interesting, the word professional, as you used it, many times the word professional gets this connotation that we're separate and we're not close. If we're supposed to be professional, we're not close. And I know that many times when couples come to my office or the families come to my office and they're really are being disrespectful to each other and give themselves the right to be angry and say whatever comes out of their mouth, I usually ask them, how do you treat, everybody 8 hours or 10 hours that you were in business? And can you bring that way of communicating and being professional actually at home? Because, there's a separateness that allows you can see another human being and you need to be polite to them and you need to actually hold their value. So the word professionalism is very interesting because it holds some level of space and respect all in it. And then yet can we feel close and compassionate while we are also feeling that, yes, we are two human beings, so we're not, the same person that we have to think that you're an extension of me. I have to listen to who you are and be respectful in my communication with you, and yet feel the closeness and compassion and heart to heart of knowing that you are a human being. And if you need something, I also need to attend to you versus just thinking of you as an object that is here to support me or my business.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And I think there is this really interesting line between going to work and keeping it professional and being able to bring your whole self to it. And, what we like to say through our work is we like to operationalize those values. So to create systems and ecosystems where you can be vulnerable and there's a time and a space to share, but it's not all encompassing because you still need to get work done and you still need to be productive and you still need to show respect. And there is a hierarchy for a purpose so that people have guidance, right? Have some sense of direction. So all of that matters. And I think that's what's so special about going in and becoming like corporate culture adjusters, right? Tweaking some things, some old traditional systems that aren't working, and infusing a little bit at a time, trying a little bit more humanity in the way in which we interact, and figuring out with that particular organization what works, right? Each organization is built so differently.
Yes.
You can't just
have completely a different culture.
Yes. You can't have one way of developing this ecosystem. First of all, you already have an ecosystem you're walking into when you're trying to do this culture adjustment. And so that's very important, is to really figure out case by case how to customize and operationalize the values from the leadership down. And not only from the leadership down, but from the bottom up, where you align both what the employee base is telling you and what you as a leader desire, and find some way to meet in the middle.
When you're looking at the, by the way, everyone, please, you're listening to Inner Voice show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. I'm talking to Molly Panpetit from SOAR Community. And if you wanted to contact her, go to www.soarcommunitynetwork.com. So you know what we're talking about. We're talking about Molly and her husband creating this wonderful business, SOAR Community Network, which they go into businesses and they create conscientious leaders for a better world. And that is something that we really need, because I can see that every time we all have to work, and every time that our work environment, that again 8, 10, 12 hours of work environment is not working for us emotionally, physically, psychologically, relationally, that it disrupts our whole system. When it doesn't work for us financially, it disrupts our whole system. So having a community that is related to work and related to our finances and related to our sense of purpose and ego, and a lot of times who we are, and not ego from I'm talking more of a healthy ego. When we really foster those cultures, and because we spend a lot of time there and a lot of our life is dependent on that culture, when we foster that culture and make it into a system that is compassionate and conscientious, that also flows to all other aspects of our life. So thank you for doing that, and thank you for taking on that concept. When you go, Molly, to a business, what is it that you're looking for first? How do you assess? And so please also talk to the audience who might have a business, or that they might be even in the companies, so that they can also see what should they be looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, typically how we work is we are referred into an organization where the leaders know that there is a need for some type of adjustment. Things are not working very well, or there's rapid growth. And with rapid growth, there's growing pains, right? You have managers and directors and executive leadership teams coming in and moving out. So we typically go in, and first and foremost, we do an overall assessment. We have a proprietary process that we use that's called the SOAR mapping process. And with those leaders, we work with them to help them see, own, articulate, and then release, meaning release it to the internal organization first, all the employees, before we take it out to market. And that process is so critical because it helps us identify if the vision and mission that first launched many years ago when the organization started is still accurate and viable today, because things change.
Yes.
Secondly, the functional areas. Functional areas are revenue generating areas of your business, organization, even nonprofits, right? Where the revenue, which is the sustainability of your organization, rests. What are those functional areas that are bringing the revenue in to sustain the organization? So we validate that. And then we also validate values, which is the most important. What is it that is so, it's non-negotiable for your organization? What do you believe in? And then we work with the employee base. We do talent insights, we do surveys, and really we help the leaders understand if they are truly on point or if they're making assumptions about their organizations and the employees are saying, that's not who we are. Please, right? They're going to places like Glassdoor and all these other sites and anonymously telling the world what it feels like to work in your organization. It's not always pretty. And so we help with that. We help to make sure that your retention, your employee happiness, that we can create and operationalize systems and programs that will continue to create a healthier and healthier ecosystem. It cannot happen in 1 month. It cannot happen in 1 year. It may take 2 or 3 years, and we may have to work, you know, team by team by team, division by division by division to get this right. And so it matters that the leaders care about their legacy. It matters that they want to invest in a culture where there's happiness, where people feel compelled to come to work, to ultimately create more social impact because of the products and services you're offering, the mission that you hope to accomplish, to create a better world, to a better community, a better society.
And when you're looking at a healthy ecosystem, environment, and a culture, what are the components of that healthy culture?
It always starts with leadership and your human capital. The leadership has to be, in my mind, progressive enough to know that they don't know everything, especially if they're fast, you know, they're growing really fast, to also have someone from the outside. I know it's easy to stay inward, but to have someone from the outside really take a look and challenge what you have been working so hard. You're in it, so you don't always see the big picture. Right, because you have to operate the business. So I think that that's very important. The leaders have to be progressive and know that they need the support. Secondly, the leaders also need development themselves. They really need to invest in executive coaching. The directors and managers need to be invested in. The talent insights of every single employee down to the person who sweeps the floor, they need to have an assessment to help the leaders understand how they're wired, what drives them, what motivates them. And that assessment should then help paint an overall picture of where the ecosystem, what the ecosystem really looks like today. Without knowing that, you're going to try and put fires out here and there, put some band-aids here and there, but you have to have a map of where you stand today before you can start tweaking and moving it into that direction, that North Star, that ideal vision that you have for the organization.
So first of all, they have to come out of the denial that, you know, kind of like the world goes around what I created at the beginning with this mission, and all is well. So as long as it all works for me, then it's fine. Then it's the awareness, as I hear you, of looking at who am I? What am I implementing? Am I still living and contributing and communicating, creating the the excitement and the passion that was there from the first mission and vision that was actually there? And is that still continuing? Then looking at, am I just in denial of and the perception of the community that works for me, or I can actually get to know the individual and the individual, how to work with this individual within the system versus I create the system and assume that every individual that comes into the system is just going to kind of mold into the system and then, you know, go forward with everything I say, because that's just not the truth with humanity. Our human, you know, human beings just don't mold into systems and, you know, follow it completely. So the awareness of people who are around me, myself and people who are around me, or the team of the leaders that are there, then it would allow to implement systems that are flexible enough to attend to each individual. And because it's attending to each individual, the compassion is there, the respect is there, and then it creates that type of a conscientious space. And then the open communication that is there, because you're asking people to tell you about who they are and what makes them tick and what makes them motivated, what makes them hurt. They will feel valued. They will feel seen for what they need also. And then that all creates this type of a healthy system where communication can be there. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Absolutely. And I will say this, you know, when leaders, especially the founders or the partners perhaps that started the organization, when you have rapid growth, you will become further and further away from the day to day. You have to step up and be the visionary, and you have to integrate and look at the big picture. And at the same time, that's why it's so important to operationalize and put these systems in place so that there's a routine for humanizing, you know, the experience of coming to work. To have, we have a partner that does mind teams, so many masterminds that are embedded inside the organization so that the employees have a safe place to go. The managers and the directors need to be empowered, because if you're the founder and you have hundreds or thousands of employees, you don't have the capacity to answer all of your emails or to see every single person. But if you create a culture where everyone at the management level who happens to take care of their people or has it responsible and accountable to it, if they're empowered, if they're developed into conscientious, more compassionate, more empathetic leaders, because those can be developed. It's not natural to everybody, but those can be developed over time. Then you create this culture where from the top, even though that person isn't in front of every single employee, their resonance, their vibration, their belief of the greater good for my community, which has to start inside. If you can't take care of your own people as family, and then you neglect them and just serve the consumers very quickly will find out. There's too much technology and tools to know, to have access to these days. So that's very important, that leaders need to take care of their internal family members, I like to say, internal team first, before making those brand promises out into the world.
I've also sensed that many of the companies who also have a bigger vision in creating something for the larger community in the world. So not only that they're producing something and they're being profitable, when they also take part of that profit and allow, you know, their even employees to share this type of profits within an action which gives to the community at large. They create projects, they do things. I really sense that the employees for those companies feel the sense of pride when they are working for that company. And many times when you tell them what your company is doing, they'll spend 1 minute talking about the product of the company and 5 minutes, let's say, about what the organization is doing for the rest of the community or, you know, the global village at large. So this type of a conscientiousness also leads itself to that type of a little bit of an altruism or sense of pride and mission and feeling greatness of an employee also has within that company.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's so much data now that is coming in to let us know that it really is mathematical. It's not just a theory, or it's not just woo-woo talk anymore. People really want, consumers, about 70% now, it's a huge number, at least this is what I've read most recently, about 70% of the consumers want to know what your brand stands for. They want to even know, to a degree, your political stance, but certainly what your stance is on social issues. Because consumers now want to know that if I'm spending money on you, if I'm giving my hard-earned dollars to buy your products or to utilize your services, where is it going back to? You know, is it going to create a better world? Is it going to map or align itself to the things that matter to me? This is so important for business owners and even nonprofits and NGOs to know. Our consumers are demanding that we have a clear, clear idea of what our vision and mission is and what we stand for. Not just what our vision of the corporate vision and mission, but where is our dollars, where is our energy, where are all of our resources going to ultimately at the end of the day to serve their community in a greater way.
Tell everybody how they can find you on podcasts or your TV show and all of those.
The best thing to do is go to SOAR, S-O-A-R, communitynetwork.com. There's so many links there, and I'm all over social media, Mali Ponpadit, or SCN, SOAR Community Network for short, and then our new initiative, Nebula. Please check out nebula.soarcommunitynetwork.com.
So tell us about Nebula really quick.
Nebula is a resource hub that we build. It's a membership platform where conscious leaders from all walks of life, civic leaders, spiritual leaders, corporate leaders can come and can consume data and give data, give information so we can collaborate, connect, and mastermind for a better world.
Oh, that's fantastic. So go to soarcommunitynetwork.com and find Mali Ponpedit and connect to the group of conscientious leaders that are there and become one. That's the best thing that you could ever do for yourself, for the community that you have, and for the world at large. Thank you so much, Mali, for joining me, and hope to see you more and more. I wish you the best with all that you're doing, and I thank you for what you're doing for all of us in a global way.
Thank you as well.
And for everyone who's listening, thank you so much for being with us. Create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And we'll be back next week, same time. Bye-bye.